This is The Guardian.
Today, a severe energy crisis that nobody saw coming. Looking back, you can see where the dominoes started to fall. Like last winter, which was really freezing, and a lot of us turned the heating up. And then the summer in the UK was weirdly still, the weakest winds in 60 years, slowing the turbines right down. Unless you follow energy news, you mightn't have realised Russia's been exporting less gas to Europe over the past few months. It wasn't clear why. And in what seems like a good thing, economies around the world are bouncing back from COVID quicker than expected. Then, on top of all that, a huge fire in Kent last week shut down vital power cables linking the UK's electricity supply to mainland Europe. None of these things seemed connected at the time. This week, we learned it was a recipe for a gas shortage that seemingly emerged from nowhere, but which has been building under our noses for nearly a year. It sent energy costs spiralling, will soon hit the budgets of vulnerable families, and threatens to dent the economic recovery. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, what a winter of soaring gas prices will mean for all of us. Gillian Ambrose, you're The Guardian's energy correspondent, and you've had an unexpected surge of work over the past week. When we read that there's an energy crisis, what exactly are we running short of?
Well, the big problem at the moment is a global tightness of gas supplies. So that's countries across the world all have a really high demand for gas, and there are concerns that there might not be enough to go around. Certainly, it's been enough to drive prices to record levels, again, across the globe. So the UK in particular is in quite a tight spot at the moment.
How severe are these gas shortages?
Well, at the moment, we're not running short of gas at all. It's important to say that. And the Secretary of State, Kwasi Kwarteng, has been very eager to tell everybody that we're not going to run out of gas
this winter. There is absolutely no question, Mr. Speaker, of the lights going out or people being unable to heat their homes. There'll be no three-day working weeks or a throwback to the 1970s. Such thinking, Mr. Speaker, is alarmist, unhelpful and completely misguided.
My bigger concern is not whether gas molecules are coming into the country or whether there are enough electrons in the system. It's what happens to people when they can't afford those electrons and those gas molecules. The Secretary of State said yesterday that no one would have to go without heating this winter. And that simply isn't true. When you look at these price increases, it's set to push at least 500,000 extra people into fuel poverty. There will absolutely be people who have to choose between heating and eating. People will have to turn off their radiators. People have to pile on blankets just to protect themselves from those bills. And at the same time, we're seeing major factories already shutting down in order to protect themselves from high gas prices. So in a sense, we already do have shortages. We are already running out of affordable gas. I think the energy crisis is already upon us.
Okay, to try and get a sense of why this is happening, let's take a step back. Where does Britain get gas from? Who's providing it and how does it get here?
Well, the UK has quite a diverse range of gas sources, actually, and that usually plays to our favour. So as everyone knows, the UK still has North Sea gas. There's not as much as there used to be, but there is still some. We also have gas which comes via pipeline from Norway, and they are a very regular and reliable supplier of gas. But then we also have pipelines that link to Europe, to the Netherlands and to Belgium. And then we get shipments of gas, so giant tankers, super chilled to keep the gas in liquid form. And that comes usually from Qatar, but increasingly from the US too. So there's quite a lot of places that the gas can come from. The problem, though, is that all of those places have really expensive gas at the moment.
And why is that? I mean, why have prices for gas in all of these different places suddenly shot up?
Well, it's partly due to COVID-19, would you believe? A lot of economies that have slowed down during the pandemic have now fired back up, and particularly Asian economies and China. So there's a lot of gas demand all at once. What we also saw last winter was a sort of universally cold winter season across the Northern Hemisphere. And a lot of our gas storage facilities were left really depleted by spring. So typically in summer, there's a race to refill those stocks before the next winter rolls around. And what we've seen is this huge industrial demand as economies try to get back on track at the same time that we're trying to top up these storage levels from record lows. And it's just driven demand like we've never really seen before. So prices have really skyrocketed, particularly towards the end of summer in Europe.
And so when you say prices have gone up, can you give me a sense by what percentage? Is it a skyrocketing or just kind of a marginal but important increase?
I would call it skyrocketing. We've seen gas prices in the UK more than quadruple since this time last year. So I think it was around 40 pence per therm, which is not a unit most people are used to working with. But today it's reached over 180. So that gives a scale of how things have moved up. A lot of the increase, 70%, has increased just since last month. And it's a huge concern.
That is a remarkable increase. And so you cast this as a result of an increase in demand as countries get back on their feet after the pandemic, coming after an especially cold winter last year. There's been some suggestion that this crisis might be the result of some manipulation of the market. People raise Russia, Norway. I mean, do you see a kind of human hand in this, or is it more these market forces you've been talking about?
Oh, I think the market forces are probably the main driver. That's unequivocal. There has been some speculation about the role that Russia may be playing. There may be some opportunism at work, according to EU lawmakers. Russia sends a lot of gas to Europe. Most of it isn't directly to the UK, but it does flow into the countries that we import gas from. So there's an indirect link there. And Russia has been sending just enough to cover their gas supply contracts. But really, at these prices, you would expect them to be sending more, particularly when they know that the demand is there. So there has been some speculation around why Russia wouldn't take advantage of the situation and flood Europe with gas to A, help us out, and B, make quite a lot of money. What may be the case is that Russia is using this situation to remind Europe of how important Russian gas supplies are, because it is waiting for regulatory approval for the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. This is a hugely controversial pipeline project, which is due to bring Russian gas into Germany and would double the capacity of gas flows going into Germany from Russia. It's been the subject of US sanctions.
It's very sad when Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia, where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia.
German officials deny that the controversial Nord Stream 2 pipeline will allow Russia to exert undue influence over their country.
It's been the subject of endless debate, and they are now waiting for regulators to give the yay or nay. So it's not the worst time for Russia to be reminding Europe of its reliance on their gas.
Well, it seems like that message is being received. Gillian, one of the other factors I've seen mentioned is a fire at the IFA power cable that brings electricity from France. And I wonder if that's played any part in your view.
Oh, absolutely. The UK's electricity prices have reached record levels alongside the gas prices. This is partly because the UK uses gas to make around 50% of its electricity. But then there have been a string of other things which have happened in the electricity market which have made things more difficult. The most dramatic was definitely a fire at the interconnector high voltage power cable, which links the UK to France. We've also had outages from some of our nuclear plants, which are quite old at this stage. There have also been very low wind speeds over the last few months. Most people probably haven't noticed, but apparently it's been the least windy period since 1961. So our wind turbines haven't been able to come to save the day either.
What a perfect storm of different things. Low winds, a fire, extra cold winter last year. I mean, it's bizarre that all these things can kind of coalesce to mean we have this global tightness that you've talked about, but which at this point consumers are not yet feeling. And that's because of these price caps that exist on what we actually pay for our household energy use. But of course, the companies that are actually bringing this energy in don't enjoy those price caps. And I'm wondering if they're having to pay higher prices on the market, not able to find what they need, what is that doing to them?
a lot of the small suppliers, they are struggling particularly with the wholesale price rises because they simply don't have pockets deep enough to be able to continue to buy electricity and gas for their customers in the wholesale market while sticking to that price cap. So the price cap is going to jump by over 12% from the 1st of October. And I think it's pretty safe to say it'll increase perhaps by a similar amount again in April. So if customers aren't feeling the pain yet, they will soon. There's also going to be a lot of small energy companies that go under as a result of not being able to pass on those costs immediately to customers.
And we saw two more of those companies go bust on Wednesday. That makes it 9 forced out of business this year, with warnings that plenty more are going to go the same way. Kwasi Kwarteng has said the price cap will stay.
I must stress that protecting consumers is our number one, our primary focus, and will shape our entire approach to this important issue.
Is that the right thing to do during this crisis?
I think it's really important that the price cap does stay in place because although it won't stop the price cap rising and it will still have a devastating impact on a lot of customers, I think it's right that the government is protecting customers from knee-jerk, rapid escalation in their bills, particularly as we're seeing moving forward the end of furlough schemes. A lot of people are going to have less financial support from that, and changes to national insurance and universal credit will also be piling a lot of pressure on families at the moment. We've seen a rising level of fuel poverty in recent years, and it's really difficult for people to quantify. Energy suppliers are bound by their supplier license conditions to offer help to their customers. But this means as a customer, you have to ask for it. You have to go to your energy supplier and say, can we talk about how we structure my repayments? And really have a conversation. And I think for a lot of people, that's not really realistic. There's people struggling with illness, disability. There's a huge number of factors that can affect people's lives and make it actually difficult to ask for help. And a lot of these people, it won't be in energy supplier figures, the fact that they are sitting under a pile of blankets without their heating on because they are afraid of what it'll do to their bills. People self-disconnect a lot more than people are disconnected, if that makes sense.
Okay, so prices will go up, but because of the cap, they're not going to kind of fluctuate wildly or go up as high as industry might be paying. But for those people who can't afford the increased price under the cap, can the government do anything to help them?
Well, there are schemes already in place. The Warm Homes Discount, for example, is something that people can apply for. And energy companies are offering help to customers who are struggling to pay. But really, I don't think that there's been nearly enough done in recent years to tackle the problem of fuel poverty. There have been growing calls in recent weeks, particularly because of these prices, for a social tariff. So that would be a tariff set below the price cap, which is just something that people could be able to afford. If we think of the price cap as being set at a fair level, the social tariff would be set at an affordable level. And that would be something that people who are struggling can pay every month and feel like they've paid their bill and have energy companies receive something, but it wouldn't be as high as the price cap. So growing calls for a social tariff, and there's no sign yet that the government or the regulator will be able to do anything, certainly not for this winter.
And in terms of this global tightness you've been talking about, do you expect it to last throughout the winter?
Yeah. I think most experts don't see any sign of this easing too much. Factors which could help is if Russia decided to start sending more gas into Europe, that would be helpful. The Norwegians have said that they will, from October, begin to send more gas into Europe. So that is also great. And if the winter weather isn't too harsh, if the winter isn't too long, these are all factors that could help. On the UK side in particular, if our power plants hold up, if they don't need any unplanned maintenance, if there are no more calamities, then that would be really helpful as well for UK prices. But the macro picture does look quite tight for the rest of winter.
Okay, so we're hoping for relief from either Russia or the winter weather.
Yeah.
Very good situation to be in. Gas, energy, obviously is the bloodline not just of our homes, but virtually every industry. What's going to happen to the wider economy once that supply gets more expensive and harder to secure?
I think that's a really, really important question, and it's not one that the government is tackling head on at the moment. Ed Miliband has raised concerns that there has been some government complacency around the economic impact. And that's because we're starting to see headlines around a return to the 3-day working week, driven by the fact that a lot of companies just won't be able to afford to operate because energy costs are a big part of every single business across the country. Everyone has an energy bill to pay. And I think for steelmakers, for those major industries, their energy bills are a major part of their costs. So if they are having to reduce hours and cut back, that is a major blow to productivity. It's also a blow to their personal company finances. And that's the kind of thing that leads to job losses. That is the last thing that the UK needs as it tries to pull itself out of the financial fallout of the COVID pandemic. So it is a concern. It's particularly concerning because a lot of these companies that are most exposed to energy prices are in the north of the country. Think of all those steelmakers and manufacturers and fertilizer companies that we've seen in the news.
The threat comes after two huge fertilization plants in Teesside shut down due to gas price rises. CO2 is a byproduct.
They are the ones that are going to suffer, and the local communities that really rely on those jobs will be on the front line of that. So it is a real concern.
The domino effect of this is remarkable. We've already heard about CO2 shortages, which I suspect many of us hadn't realised was crucial for everything from the NHS to abattoirs and ensuring things like the supply of meat to supermarket shelves.
The owner of one large poultry group, which includes Bernard Matthews, called the carbon dioxide issue a massive body blow. It's used by meat producers, including in the packaging process.
We use CO2 for, it's used to extend shelf life through packaging, not just in meat, but on all foods. And at a time when we're struggling because of the haulage shortages in this country to keep the supply chain running, to actually lose shelf life and have a shorter shelf life on the products going onto shelves is going to cause even more disruption. So this is a really serious problem for us.
Now, the government has struck a deal with an American CO2 company to avoid this kind of disruption of supply. But what about the UK's energy industry? It's clearly going to be transformed by this. I saw at the start of the year there were 70 energy companies in the market right now. And potentially, once this crisis is over, there might be just 10 remaining. I mean, the first thing is, I was amazed that there were that many companies doing this to begin with. Like, how did we get to that state?
That's absolutely right. The energy market first began to change in a very radical way in about 2014, and that's when the energy regulator decided to open up the market a bit more, to drop those barriers to entry, to encourage more entrepreneurs to come into the market and set up energy supply businesses. This was a very deliberate attempt to create more competition for the big six. And perhaps in some ways it worked, because we've seen the big six have to cut their costs and tighten their belts and drop their prices. But in that time, we've seen a huge number of companies come in, some great, some really innovative, and some really, really terrible. And I think it's okay for me to say that. Some have offered really poor customer service. They've not had the financial heft to be able to operate responsibly in a market that should be taken seriously.
Among these startups, we've seen the rise of some of these green companies that, you know, promise to deliver energy in a more environmentally sustainable way. Are they likely to survive what's coming?
I think some will and some won't. It'll come down to the strength of the company and whether it has the support of investors and bankers behind it. A lot of companies that sell green electricity, for example, they can sell you 100% renewable electricity. But when it comes to selling gas, gas is still gas. And maybe they're selling carbon offsets alongside so that you can negate the carbon impact of using that gas, but they're still having to buy gas from the wholesale market. So if they are offering gas alongside their green electricity, they could still be exposed to the same pressures as the rest of the market.
And for those whose energy companies do go under in the next few weeks or months, what are their options?
There are plans in place to manage this process, and the government is looking at bolstering those for the coming winter to be able to cope with the sheer number of companies that are likely to collapse.
When an energy supplier typically fails, Mr. Speaker, Ofgem appoints another supplier to take on serving the customers, and there is no interruption to supply. I reiterate.
But it's expected that millions of people will have their supplier go bust this winter. So on top of higher bills, there will also be some level of uncertainty and I suppose anxiety around the fact that your supplier has gone under.
Gillian, you've cast this as part of a global trend. You called it a global tightening. And I'm wondering, are other countries facing a similar problem?
Absolutely. Countries across Europe have probably raised the alarm over this sooner than the UK has. And they are facing record high prices as well. Not as high as the UK's prices, but still really troubling. And one really interesting sort of headline-grabbing move from Spain has been a windfall tax on the major generators and operators of gas companies. So companies that stand to make quite a lot of money from supplying gas and electricity at the moment at a wholesale level. So not the suppliers, but the producers of the gas and the generators of electricity. They're going to put in place this tax to create a 3 billion euro fund, which they will then use to lower energy bills for consumers.
We are going to take away those extraordinary profits that the energy companies are making. They can afford it, and we are going to redirect them to consumers to cap the gas bill in the face of the foreseeable increase in the price of gas in the coming months.
And that is not something I think we'll see in the UK, to be honest. But it's a very interesting step that's been taken, a very bold step. And other schemes are being considered in France and Greece as well to help to manage just this unprecedented crisis.
Yeah, I mean, global crisis, but you said that the UK is worse affected. And I'm wondering, is there something about this country that makes it especially vulnerable to this kind of disruption?
Basically, there is no part of the situation that couldn't be made better by the UK being less reliant on fossil fuels. The UK relies a lot on gas, both for electricity generation and also for our home heating and cooking. So we are quite exposed to that. And also we have some of the lowest gas storage levels in Europe. On the electricity front, we rely a lot on importing electricity from the continent. And if their prices are high, then our prices will be higher. And then, yeah, we've seen a string of very local mishaps, outages and things, which has just made the situation for the UK quite a lot tougher. But it is very evident that the UK's energy crisis is a step above our neighbours. We really are seeing prices quite a lot higher than what they're seeing in France and Germany.
Yeah, and I'm surprised that successive governments have allowed us to get into the situation you've described, where it seems like the worst of all worlds, where we're very dependent on gas, but then don't actually store very much of it.
Yeah, it's also the case historically. We've always had the North Sea, and we still do. It still meets around 50% of our demand, but production is falling there. And I think perhaps we haven't realized that we're still behaving like a gas giant, but we don't really have the reserves to back that up anymore.
Coming up, can the UK break its addiction to fossil fuels and avoid a repeat of this crisis? So with this vulnerability now exposed, what are the options for making the energy system more resilient?
Well, the good thing is that we have seen statements coming from the government saying that really this crisis drives forward the agenda, which is to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. So a lot of the arguments in favour of investment in local renewable energy production gets a boost from this kind of thing. Things like hydrogen, green hydrogen, for example, which you could make during the summer from renewable energy and water and can then be stored until the winter and through the winter and used in gas power plants, used in industry as well to make fertilizer and ammonia and things like that.
The timing of this is interesting in that Boris Johnson's been in New York trying to lay the groundwork for COP26, which will be hugely focused on persuading the world, particularly the developing world, to move away from fossil fuel.
And one of the things that we're doing is trying to get people to move away from hydrocarbons, from reliance on hydrocarbons, to putting in clean, green energy sources on which our country can rely for generations to come.
One thing we've seen in recent weeks is a crisis in the supply chain. We discussed it on the podcast last week. On top of that, we saw the disruption to global trade caused by a boat stuck in the Suez earlier this year.
Yeah.
And now these looming gas shortages. And it seems like a lot of the systems that we rely on, perhaps take for granted, are a lot more fragile than we thought. Is this all a hangover from the pandemic, or is there something larger going on here?
I think you're absolutely right. Before the pandemic, we were moving through the world not realizing that everything was really fine-tuned and that the smallest disruption could sort of ripple through the global economy and cause quite so much chaos. I think the pandemic has played a huge role in what we're seeing today in the energy market. I also think perhaps this is also part of a reaction against globalization. We've seen this sort of global energy market, particularly with gas, and how exciting it is that we can take gas from Australia and it can be sent on a ship to China, and US shale can help heat our homes in Britain. But this is really taking the shine off. I think we're starting to see that as not as fantastic as we initially thought. So there is a sort of move back to self-sufficiency and wanting to keep things a bit more local. So it does tend to mirror a lot of bigger macro trends that we're seeing as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this in terms of the global energy market, the politics of the crisis for Boris Johnson's government. But in real terms, this is going to hit people where it really hurts. And I wonder how you see that effect is going to be.
Yeah, I absolutely think you're right. I think the impact will be huge. And perhaps in 5 or 6 months' time, we'll see this all coming to fruition. And I don't necessarily think people will be talking about energy prices in isolation anymore, because I think it will have led into so much of the economy that we'll be looking at, I don't know, perhaps an economic crisis. The implications will ripple through and the government will be facing just an affordability crisis, really, is what I think is coming down the road.
Gillian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
That was Gillian Ambrose, The Guardian's energy correspondent. You can read all our coverage of the gas shortage and its consequences at theguardian.com. And hear more about it in this week's episode of Politics Weekly, where Torsten Bell and Larry Elliott discuss the ramifications for Boris Johnson's government. That is all for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. Back Friday.
This is The Guardian.